I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This episode, you'll hear the first half of my interview with Ron Bailey about libertarian politics and the state of biopolitics and the Tea Party and things like that. And then in the second half of this podcast, there is the third installment of Clockwork Fagin, a story from Cory Doctorow and the collection Steampunk, an anthology of fantastically rich and strange stories. I'm talking today with Ron Bailey. Ron and I are old friends. We met 12 years ago at an Alcor meeting and crossed paths at a lot of different conferences and things. And of course, I have followed and reposted his writings often over the years, although sometimes with snarky intros, because depending on what he writes about, I loathe or love what Ron says. But Ron has been a correspondent for almost 25 years now. And he is most recently, for the last 15 years, I guess, at Reason Magazine. He's the author of False Prophets of Ecological Collapse, and one I didn't like very much, and one I did like a lot, Liberation Biology, The Moral and Scientific Case for the Biotech Revolution, which he published about 5 years ago. And that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today. Welcome, Ron.
Delighted to be with you.
So you wrote that Liberation Biology 5 years ago, right after I brought out Citizen Cyborg, and we were both engaged in this emerging biopolitical polarization that was happening with the bioliberals going off and beating up on the Kassites and the Kassites beating up on us. My book was about how libertarians and leftists could work together but had distinct points of view, and your book was an articulation of some of that as well. Now, 6 years later, it doesn't look like, it looks like a lot of that's been eclipsed by the global economic collapse, and a lot of what we expected to be the burning issues of the day have not yet come to pass. Or do you have a different sensibility with your ear to your piece of the ground?
Well, I think that what happened is that a lot of the issues that we were talking about, such as stem cell research and so forth, and also some of the work on things like PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and so forth, have become mainstream. That basically a lot of the opposition in Congress and in other purlieus of politics has gone away. The stem cell research is moving forward, not as fast as I suspect we'd like, but it is moving forward. The political roadblocks have been more or less removed. And things like PGD, as I say, I believe are now mainstream. People know about it, and they basically applaud it when people take advantage of the technology to make sure that the children that they do have are healthy. So those kinds of things, I think, are already won, if you will.
Well, the PGD is non-controversial when it's for, as you say, for making sure that kids are healthy, but there are applications that are still quite controversial, like sex selection and cosmetic selection, things like that. And do you see progress on people embracing a broader notion of what reproductive rights might entail in, around those things?
Well, actually, that's a good point that you make. One of the problems, as you know, is that the bioconservatives are two wings. There are the people who are sort of the neoconservatives, and then, of course, you have the very far-left people like Marcy Darnofsky and her group of people. And they have different, they approach the problem differently, but they come to the same prohibitionist result, basically. They don't want people to take advantage of these technologies for things like sex selection. And you know, when you bring up sex selection, you look around the world. Of course, that has been a problem in largely Asian and South Asian cultures. But if you look at the data in Europe and the United States, it hasn't been a problem. The last time I looked at the data, sex selection was being used in the United States basically to produce girls, largely as a form of family balancing. So I don't think that's as big a problem here. And again, I don't, people, as we've had that. famous bioethical concept of the yuck factor. I think the yuck factor, even in that case in the United States, the valence of that is going down.
When the Obama administration appointed their bioethics commission, it was a lot of technocrats, a lot of people from different parts of the health bureaucracy, and very relatively few bioethicists, even fewer than had been in the CAST commission, and we weren't terribly happy with the ones that they chose. And so what do you think's happening up there? Part of it, as you and I know, was because of Zeke Emanuel getting beaten up so bad in the lead up to the healthcare reform debate, and but what else was going on with that?
Well, I think that Obama did want to avoid some of the political controversy that had attended other bioethics commissions before. I mean, it wasn't just the CAST commission, of course. There were commissions for under Bill Clinton, for example, and he ignored some of their advice as well because he found it politically untenable for various and sundry reasons, specifically with regard to research on embryos. So this is, you know, these commissions have had controversy since their inception, in fact. But this particular one, I think, was in that wonderful Obama-esque way that we're all now familiar with, designed to drain, if you will, controversy out of it. And he hasn't really gone to them for any particular information, and they're not very proactive as far as I can tell. The only real report they've done was on synthetic biology, and that report is almost completely unobjectionable. They see no reason to regulate it at this time, largely speaking.
Unobjectionable, you know, from a bioliberal point of view.
Yes, I think that's correct. There are people like the ETC group, again, on the far left, who are, you know, as usual, alarmed about any new technologies that are coming down the pike because they're not, quote-unquote, democratically controlled, and you may want to speak to that yourself. But, again, what I find fascinating about that commission report is that once it came out as an issue, it simply died politically and in the media, and researchers are moving forward in that field largely unhindered.
Well, now you're raising one of the issues that we have debated over the years about the relevance of democratic control. Isn't this an example of a commission that pulled together expert testimony and considered whether there should be a call for regulation or alarm bells rung, and they decided that there weren't issues to be raised yet about that?
And for once, democracy worked. There are many more examples, as we discussed, of, in fact, if you look abroad, particularly to Western Europe, you find the democratic controls there are basically trying to stop the advance of almost all of these technologies and have certainly slowed them in the past. This goes to genetically modified crops, for example, where it is factually the case that not a single person on the planet has gotten a bellyache, a sniffle, or a sneeze from eating any foods made with biotech crops. And they're largely very good for the environment. And yet you find this particular democratic control in Europe blocking their advancement there. And then, of course, you can review all kinds of laws in Europe with regard to controlling reproduction and the kinds of things that people are allowed to do that are not illegal in the United States. So democratic control, I suspect, largely is conservative control. Again, the problem is that something new comes along and people react to it negatively. People hate change. And what you really want to do is empower the people who are in favor of change to go ahead and experiment with it. And if it works out, then everybody will like it. And if it doesn't work out, there'll be a horrible warning.
Well,
that would be my argument, as you know.
Yes, I do. Last week,
tiresome though it may be to you.
Well, you know, I certainly agree that it's two steps forward and one step back at best in a lot of these kinds of regulatory debates. I just don't think they're avoidable. I mean, I don't think most people are willing to adopt a completely libertarian approach. And I was reminded of this last week when Sweden, which is one of the few countries that provides sex reassignment surgery as a guaranteed right of all transgender citizens, as a part of their national healthcare system, the conservatives are now in power in Sweden, And they pushed through a policy that if you are a trans man, that is born a female, became a man, that you have to have your ovaries or your tubes tied or your ovaries taken out or whatever, because they didn't want to have the situation of trans men having children. They argued that you had to be, you know, they had a very conservative notion about what gender entailed. And it's like, on the one hand, yeah, it's great socialist support for transsexual surgery. On the other hand, the conservatives get to determine what constitutes a man and a woman.
And thereby hangs the problem. I don't think that people should be allowed to vote on that kind of activity.
Yeah. Well, in the States, you're lucky because transgender surgery has a much more open and less regulatory field. But if you want to have that sex assignment surgery, you have to come up with $50,000 to $100,000.
Which, of course, I don't see as a problem.
Okay, so we're in this situation where libertarians of some stripe, whatever the Tea Party represents, have been emboldened and organized and focused by the debt crisis and the fact that we've spent $1 trillion on wars in the Middle East. And so you have a pretty strong voice for at least economic libertarianism in the Republican Party. And I know that Reason folks have been debating. I read Reason and find the debate fascinating. And I know that there's long been a debate between left libertarians or folks who focus mostly on social issues and economic libertarians and whether they should side more with the Republicans or the Democrats. But I was just wondering what the current thinking in the editorial room is nowadays. Is it, are the Tea Party folks still the, you know, the kind of folks that you could get behind, or are they kind of scary and proto-fascist on the edges?
Well, that was a leading question.
That's what I specialize in.
Well, first of all, I mean, again, libertarians, basically, I think, I hesitate to say it this way, but basically, as you know, we're in favor of things like gay marriage and legalizing drugs, and I don't mean just some drugs, but all drugs. On the other hand, we would like as little government interference with our private economic lives as is possible to get as well. So the real issue, the debate that often comes up is on foreign policy. What do you do when, if you will, to put it in crudest terms, another tribe attacks our tribe? And that's always going to be fraught. And full disclosure, I was in favor of the invasion of Iraq, and I am now completely chastened by that. I was wrong. I should have recognized that government can even screw up a war, and they certainly have done so in this particular case. So that is a disclosure, and I think that basically you will find that most of the people at Reason in the editorials side and at the foundation are basically against the wars now, and for unfortunately good reasons. This is not theoretical anymore. It's been very empirically based. Alaska, the damage to our civil liberties that these wars have caused at home, plus of course the squandering of treasure abroad, is very chastening to me. So that being said, with regard to the Tea Party, a lot of my colleagues are I tend to do policy and not politics so much, but a lot of my colleagues are encouraged by the Tea Party to some extent. My two editors, essentially, Matt Welch and Nick Gillespie, have just published a book called The Declaration of Independence. I mean, just now out. Was up to 161 on Amazon, I believe, where they're basically pointing out that over the last 30 years or so, what you find is dramatically declining party identification. In fact, in some of the polls, you'll find that the largest group anymore is are people who are self-described independents. And when Matt and Nick parse the data, a lot of these people are libertarian operationally. They just don't know what they are otherwise. And a lot of them have gone into the Tea Party. Now, there's some aspects of the Tea Party that, how shall we say this, some of the Christian conservatives have decided, in my opinion, I would describe it as trying to hijack what was essentially an economic movement and try to corral these people into a social movement. And so far, I don't believe that's worked, but that is on the edges there, and I think we should definitely oppose that. So that's my analysis of it. And what will be interesting to see is how they break in the 2012 election. The Republicans and the Democrats, how should we say, the blue team and the red team, are both failing the country enormously at this point, and I think the public feels that way about it. And who captures the narrative for 2012 is up in the air right now.
The seeing Ron Paul at some of these debates, presidential debates, as it was, you know, 4 years ago, is just fascinating. It reminds me of Ayn Rand back in the 1960s, you know, that conservatives being delighted by her trumpeting of the free market, and then she'd get up there and say, and of course you have to give up your stupid belief in God, and then they'd all sit back on their heels a little bit.
She was officially drummed out of the conservative movement by Bill Buckley, you know.
I did. When was that?
This was in the early 1960s.
Okay, good. Well, and she didn't like them very much either. But yeah. But Ron Paul has, you know, he illustrates some of these dilemmas, and the fact that Rand Paul is now in Congress, and he has much more fervently embraced the Christian conservatives and that wing of the Tea Party phenomenon. But Rand is also, you know, pretty forthright, you know, about some of his libertarian, radical libertarian positions. So do you think that there is a, you know, that those phenomena, Rand and Ron Paul and that whole wing, that there could be an independence from the Republicans and a split? I mean, that's for liberals like myself, that would always be, of course, welcomed to see.
Well, of course, what we could always enjoy, put it this way, is, as a libertarian, as I say, I have no brief for either the red team or the blue team. Both of them are really screwing up from my point of view. But, you know, the being boring political scientist kind of guy, what happens, as you know, is that tendencies bubble up in American politics, and they attach themselves to one party or the other and drag them in their direction over time. So you get subtle shifts in policies, and particularly in the kinds of legislation that are going to be proposed and that kind of thing. But this moment is one of those moments, possibly, when one of the two major parties could disappear as new coalitions are organized in the future. I don't know that it will happen. Both parties have spent a great deal of time creating barriers to allowing third parties to come into existence, all kinds of campaign contribution laws, which are being slowly but surely being dismantled by the Supreme Court in the name of free speech, as they should be. But also voter registration laws and that kind of thing, where basically they're trying desperately to maintain their duopoly, if you will, their oligopoly on our politics. And part of what might happen is that one of them could collapse. I don't know. It would be really hard to say which one at this point. But, you know, you may have your wish in the sense that Republicans could split and go away, but you may not like what comes in their place.
Probably true. This has been the first half of my interview with Ron Bailey. For the second half of the interview, go to IET.org. And now we're going to listen to the third installment of Clockwork Fagin from Cory Doctorow's Steampunk, an anthology of fantastically rich and strange stories from Candlewick Press at candlewick.com. And Cory's podcasts can be found at his website, craphound.com, which he has very generously made available in this open source fashion. And I very much appreciate it. Urge you all to read his work, buy the collection, and listen to his podcasts.
There were two children who'd worked for a tanner in the house, older children. Matthew was shy all the fingers on his left hand. Becca was missing an eye in her nose, which she joked was a mercy, for there is no smell more terrible than the charnel reek of the tanning works. But between them, they were quite certain that they could carefully remove, stuff, and remount Grinder's head, careful to leave the jaw in place. As the oldest machinist at St. Aggie's, I was conscripted to work on the torso and armature mechanisms. I play chief engineer, bossing a gang of 6 boys and 4 girls who had experience with mechanisms. We cannibalize St. Aggie's old mechanical washwringer with its spindly arms and many fingers. I was sent out several times to pawn Grinder's fine crystal and pocket watch to raise money for parts. Monty oversaw all, but he took personal charge of Grinder's voice box, through which he would imitate old Grinder's voice when the sisters came by on Sunday. St. Aggie's was fronted with a Dutch door, and Grinder habitually only opened the top half to jaw with the sisters. Monty said that we could prop the partial torso on a low table, to hide the fact that no legs depended from it. We'll tie a sick kerchief around his face and give out that he's got the flu, and that it's spread through the whole house. That'll get us all out of church, which is a tidy little jackpot in and of itself. The kerchief will disguise the fact that his lips ain't moving in time with his talking. I shook my head at this idea. The nuns were hardly geniuses, but how long could this hold out for? It won't have to last more than a week. By next week, we'll have something better to show him. Here's a thing. It all worked like a fine-tuned machine. The kerchief made it look like a bank robber, and Monty painted its face to make him seem more lively, for the tanning had dried him out some. He also doused the horrible thing with liberal lashings of bay rum, and greased its hair with a heavy pomade, for the tanning process had left him with a smell like an outhouse on a hot day. Monty had affixed an armature to the thing's bottom jaw. We'd had to break it to get it open, prying it roughly with a screwdriver, cracking a tooth or two in the process, and I have nightmares to this day about the sound it made when it finally yawed open. A child, little legless Dora, whose begging pitch included a sad little puppetry show, could work this armature by means of a squeeze bulb taken from the siphon starter on Grinder's cider brewing tub, and so made the jaw go up and down in time with speech. The speech itself was accomplished by means of the horse gut voice box from Grinder's music box. Monty sure-handedly affixed a long, smooth glass tube, part of the cracking apparatus I had been sent to the market to buy, to the music box's resonator. This he ran up behind our automatic grinder. Then, crouched on the floor before the voice box, stationed next to Dora on her wheeled plank, he was able to whisper across the horse gut strings and have them buzz out a credible version of Grinder's whiskey ruffin growl. And once he tuned the horse gut just so, the vocal resemblance was even more remarkable. Combined with Dora's skillful puppetry, the effect was galvanizing. It took a conscious effort to remember that this was a puppet talking to you, not a man. The sisters turned up at the appointed hour on Sunday, only to be greeted by our clockwork Grinder, stood in the half-door, face swathed in a flu mask. We'd hung quarantine bunting from the windows, crisscrossing the front of St. Aggie's with it for good measure, and a goodly number of us kiddies were watching from the upstairs windows with our best drawn and sickly looks on our faces. So the sisters hung back practically at the pavement and shouted, "Mr. Grindersworth!" in alarmed tones, staring with horror at the apparition in the doorway. "Sisters, good day to you," Monty said into his horse gut, while Dora worked her squeeze bulb and the jaw went up and down behind its white cloth, and the muffled simulation of Grinder's voice emanated from the top of the glass tube, hidden behind the automaton's head, so that it seemed to come from the right place. "Though not such a good day for us, I fear."
"The children are ill?"
Monty gave out a fine sham of Grinder's laugh, the one he used when dealing with proper people, with the cruelty barely plastered over. "Oh, not all of them, but we have a dozen cases. Thankfully, I appear to be immune, and oh my, but you wouldn't believe the help these tots are in the practical nursing department. Fine kiddies, my charges, yes indeed. But still, best to keep them away from the general public for the nonce, hey? I'm quite sure that we'll have them up on their feet by next Sunday, and they'll be glad indeed of the chance to get down on their knees and thank the beneficent Lord for their good health." Monty was laying it on thick, but then, so had Grinder when it came to the sisters.
"We shall send over some help after the services," the head sister said, hands at her breast, a tear glistening in her eye at the thought of our bravery.
I thought the jig was up. Of course the order would have some sisters who'd had the flu and gotten over it, rendering them immune. But Monty never worried. "No, no," he said smoothly. I had the presence of mind to make the cranks that operated the arms we constructed for him, waving them about in a negating way. This effect was rather spoiled by my nervousness, so that they seemed more octopus tentacle than arm, but the sisters didn't appear to notice. "As I say, we have plenty of help here with my good children."
"A basket, then," the sister said. "Some nourishing food and fizzy drinks for the children."
Crouching low in the anteroom, we crippled children traded disbelieving looks with one another. Not only had Monty gotten rid of Grinder and gotten us out of going to church, but he'd also set things up so that the sisters of St. Aggie's were going to bring us their best grub for free because we were all so poorly and ailing. It was all we could do not to cheer. And cheer we did later when the sisters set 10 huge hampers down on our doorstep, whence we retrieved them, finding in them a feast fit for princes. Cold meat pies glistening with aspic, marrow bones still warm from the oven, suet puddings and jugs of custard with skin on top of them, huge bottles of fizzy lemonade and small beer. By the time we laid it out in the dining room, it seemed like we'd never be able to eat it all. But we ate every last morsel, and four of us carried Monty about on our shoulders, two carrying, two steadying the carriers, and someone found a concertina, and someone found some combs and wax paper, and we all sang until the walls shook, the mechanic's folly, a combinatorial explosion at the computer works, and endless rounds of "For he's a jolly good fellow." Monty had promised improvements on the clockwork grinder by the following Sunday, and he made good on it. Since we no longer had to beg all day, we children of St. Aggie's had time and plenty, and Monty had no shortage of skilled volunteers who wanted to work with him on the Grinder 2, as he called it. Grinder 2 sported a rather handsome and large droopy mustache, which hid the action of its lips. This mustache was glued onto the head assembly one hair at a time, a painstaking job that denuded every horsehair brush in the house, but the effect was impressive. More impressive was the leg assembly I bossed into existence, a pair of clockwork pins that could lever Grinder from a seated position into full upright, balancing him by means of three gyros we hid in his chest cavity. Once these were wound and spun, Grinder could stand up in a very natural fashion. Once we'd rearranged the furniture to hide Dora and Monty behind a large armchair, you could stand right in the parlor and converse with him, and unless you were looking very hard, you'd never know but what you were talking with a mortal man, and not an automaton made of tanned flesh, steel, springs, and clay. We'd used rather a lot of custom-made porcelain from the prosthetics works to get his legs right. The children who were shy a leg or two knew which leg makers in town had the best wares. And so when the sisters arrived the following Sunday, they were led right into the parlor, whose net curtains kept the room in a semi-dark state, and there they parlayed with Grinder, who came to his feet when they entered and left. One of the girls was in charge of his arms, and she had practiced with him so well that she was able to move them in a very convincing fashion. Convincing enough, any road. The sisters left Grinder with a bag of clothes, a bag of oranges that had come off a ship that sailed from Spanish Florida, right up the St. Lawrence to the port of Montreal, and thereafter traversed by rail car to Muddy York. They made a parcel gift of these succulent treasures to Grinder to help the kiddies keep away the scurvy, but Grinder's always kept them for himself or flogged them to his pals for a neat penny. We wolfed the oranges right after services, and then took our Sabbath free with games and more brandy from Grinder's sideboard.
Again, that's the third installment of Cory Doctorow reading Clockwork Fagin, a story which appears in the anthology Steampunk, an anthology of fantastically rich and strange stories, from Candlewick Press at candlewick.com, and you can subscribe to Cory's podcasts at craphound.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and produced at WRTC Hartford at Trinity College and WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and the executive director of the IEET, Jay Hughes. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email us at director@ieet.org. Also at ieet.org, you can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org and the AInfos Radio Project. Our intro and outro music were composed and recorded by IEET fellow Ricardo Campa. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and radically democratic future.